Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around, you're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and before we start today's show, I wanted to talk to all the guitar players out there about something really interesting. If you're a guitar player, or probably any other kind of musician, or if you know a musician who's looking to make some more money without having to tour or go on the road, or put up with any of the other BS that musicians normally have to deal with, then what I'm about to tell you is probably the most exciting and important message you'll ever hear. As a business guy who just happens to play guitar, one of the first things I realized after interviewing, say, the first 50 or so guitar players was that if I was going to get into this business today, the first thing I'd look at doing is learning how to license your music. And by licensing music, I mean getting your music inserted into movies, television shows, and commercials. And here's why. There are four reasons, actually. First of all, focusing on record deals, publishing, and touring means that you're putting your destiny in someone else's hands. You're at the whim of someone who has literally thousands of other people competing for their attention, many of whom, frankly, may have music with more commercial appeal than your music has, which means you get whatever left over as far as attention from that particular manager, publisher, publicist, or booking agent, right? And I don't know how you feel, but for me, I'm totally uncomfortable leaving my destiny and my family's financial future up to someone else. Second, I've learned in business that if you work in areas that are less competitive and not as crowded, your likelihood of success goes up dramatically. And there are way less people competing to have their music licensed than there are trying to make records, get their songs published, and go on tour. In fact, there are so many people competing to play music, the average working musician today, by and large, earns the same or less money than they were making back in the 1970s and 1980s. Third, in the licensing business, it's not unusual to have one or more of your songs wind up paying you multiple times over and over again. In some cases, day after day, week after week, month after month, and year after year. In fact, some songs you even get paid on multiple times over from a variety of sources because different people wind up licensing that same song from you. Many times you get paid for songs you recorded months or even years ago. So no work you do is ever wasted. Even if a particular song doesn't get picked up right now, there's a very good chance it can get picked up later. And the more music you write, the more opportunities you get for placements. The more placements, the more money you make, both up front as income from licensing fees and on the backside in terms of royalties for years to come. And the fourth reason I like this industry is that a free ebook has just been published, which pretty much takes you by the hand and shows you step by step how to get your music licensed. The book is less than 20 pages long, and it was written by Mike Elsner, who I interviewed in episode number 167 of this show. Mike's been doing this for over 14 years, and he's actually had over 2,000 songs licensed at this point in time. Now, I want you to pay attention to something, because that means he's getting paid to license almost 150 songs per year. Now, keep in mind, most successful career musicians don't even get paid for 150 songs in total over a 30 or 40 year career, yet Mike's getting paid for this on an annual basis. And in this free ebook, you'll discover the four simple steps to licensing success, including step one, which actually shows you how to get paid a significant upfront licensing fee as well as quarterly royalties. You'll learn how to get paid for learning how to play a new instrument. And I'm not kidding, he actually shows you an example of he basically practiced a new instrument and he licensed all the songs, and he walks you through this. In step two, you'll learn how to quickly expand your song catalog by 5 to 6 times its current size without having to create literally anything new. That's right, you'll learn how to easily turn 10 songs into 50 to 60 songs in less than 5 minutes each, and each one of those new songs now becomes another new asset you can sell. You'll learn what to do, and maybe even more important, what not to do to get your music quickly noticed by music supervisors. And this one simple nugget alone easily makes the difference between regularly getting your music licensed and never getting it licensed at all. He'll show you 4 ways to get paid to license your music, and then you get to pick and choose which one of those 4 ways works best for you. And you'll also get to uncover little-known secrets to using common websites online to get free names of people who would want to license your music. And the other cool thing I like about this business is that you can run it all from your home studio. No ivory tower record label executives telling you what to play and how to play it, and no shady managers or backroom publishers with their own agenda telling you what to do. So download Mike's free ebook on music licensing right now. Just go to everyonelovesguitar.com/Mike. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/Mike, M-I-K-E. That's it. Real simple. Let me know how you like the book. And now let's get on with the show. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. I have a really interesting guest today. He's a guitar player, and he does a lot of other cool things, and he's taken a little side hustle of his and made it into a major career, and he's actually teaching other people how to do that now. So I want to welcome Mike Elsner to the show. Mike's had over 2,000 placements of original music on over 600 television episodes in licensing music. He's currently the composer and the owner of the premier trailer music agency called Sonic Tremor. And they've composed music for multiple film and video game trailers, including Disney's Cinderella, which some of you may have heard of, and most recently, Mark Felt, starring Liam Neeson. He's dabbled in the world of instrumental guitar as well, with his solo album release called Stained Voodoo, which took home the award for Instrumental Album of the Year, actually, at the LA Music Awards in 2006, as well as The Pilgrimage of Thingamajig, where he had the honor to share guitar credits alongside Paul Gilbert, Richie Kotzen, and Greg Howe. Not a bad team. He also toured with Mr. Big in 2009 as Paul's guitar tech, and he's currently touring China a few times each year with a popular artist over there, and he is inventing a new mask to wear when you go to China, apparently. He's got his film commercial credits as a songwriter, producer, and a performer include there was several dozen here. I had to cut this down. American Idol, The Voice, Hannah Montana, Cold Case, Extra, The Ellen DeGeneres Show, Millionaire Matchmaker, Pawn Stars, Baywatch, ESPN, and Fox Sports Network. If you're interviewing my wife, she'd want to know about Millionaire Matchmaker. She likes that show. She was interviewing you, I should say. TV and film credits as a guitarist also include Fairly Legal, The Young and the Restless, The Bold and the Beautiful, and Victoria's Secret. I don't know what Victoria's Secret is, but I thought of like scantily clad women, so I put that down.
That was a good day.
Man, thanks for your time. I really appreciate you coming on the show. I know how busy you are, man.
Thanks for having me. And you know, I'm only 25 years old.
Ba-dum-bum. So let me ask you, what was your, like, you've done so much cool stuff. What was your career trajectory, let's say, from either post high school or post college? And, you know, how did you take that into licensing?
Well, you know, licensing was actually a mistake. I fell into it. But, I think like most people, I played in rock bands. Through college. And was in one for quite some time, and we, you know, did a bunch of records and ended up opening up for a lot of bigger acts in the Northwest. I'm sorry, Northeast, where I grew up. When that kind of ran its course around 2000, I'm sorry, not 2000, it's around 1998, I headed down to Nashville with the idea that I was just going to, you know, find a gig as a touring guitar player with an artist. But I didn't know anyone in Nashville when I moved here initially. So the only experience I'd had really in the music industry was my band. And the only experience I had beyond my band was recording studios. And I grew up in Woodstock, New York. And you know, as you know, there's a bunch of very, you know, popular, there were not so much anymore, but there were a number of very, you know, well-known popular recording studios, and I frequented them, and I just got really used to, you know, walking into a studio and just knowing my way around a studio. So when I first came to Nashville, I didn't know anything. I didn't know what to do with myself. So I just started going to some of the studios and just walking in, and I'd walk right past the front desk people because most of the time those are interns, you know, and I'd walk in like I owned the place, and I'd walk down the hallway and I'd find a room and I'd walk in and I'd stand there and I'd meet some people. And very quickly, I just got into the studio world. And then I did that for a number of years.
So wait a minute. So you would just meet people there and say, hey, are you looking for a guitarist?
No. I just hang out. And then I ended up meeting some, you know, engineers and producers. And then I just stay late and hang with them, and then show up the next day and hang out with them. And then before long, like one of them, like their assistant engineer, you know, couldn't make it one day. And he's like, hey, you know, do you know how to run a tape machine? And I was like, yeah, whatever. And at that time, they were using 8-ATs. I think they were using 8-ATs here at the time. And I didn't even know what an 8-AT was.
That's those black tape things?
Yeah, because up in New York, up where I was growing up, they were using the old Tascam DA88s, you know? And and this is 1998, you know?
So you would just literally hang out. Nobody thought it was strange that, like, you're just hanging out?
No. No. It's, you know, that's the thing is wow. I didn't know what else to do, but I was so used to hanging out in studios that I wasn't out of place walking into a studio in Nashville.
Gotcha.
You know, so, you know, by the time I moved here, I was 23. And I started hanging out. I started going to studios in Woodstock when I was 16.
Oh, okay.
You know, and so, you know, aside from playing, you know, making albums with my bands, some of the guys in Woodstock were calling me to play guitar on projects that they were doing. So by the time I moved here, I was already very familiar with the studio environment, whether that meant just hanging out or whether that meant recording, you know. And so, you know, I just made friends with people. My goal when I came here was not initially to, you know, find a gig. My goal was to make friends. And I knew that I wanted to make friends who were with people who were successful, and that's what I did. And that's kind of how the trajectory went. And then I started working as an assistant engineer. You know, I went from a guitar player to assistant engineer, and that lasted for about a year because that's not my world at all. But the cool thing was I learned a lot about engineering. You know, I took one weekend I took the manual home from an SSL, I think an 8,000 or a 6,000 console, and I read it and I learned how to run the computer on it so that I could assist the engineer the next week on the computer for the board. But that led to, you know, when I first came to town, I started meeting people and meeting writers and you know, was writing songs and becoming friends with the studio managers and whatnot. Allowed me a lot of free time in the studio to start recording my songs. So I just kind of fell into that situation. The whole time I was looking for a touring gig, but by 2000 I was producing albums.
Holy.
For artists. And
just,
that got
so, me. So just from those 2 years of hanging out in the studio and then sort of like working for free and then doing this and then doing that.
I never worked for free.
Okay. So like even when like they asked you to run something, you were compensated for it.
I was here about 2 weeks before one of the guys that I was meeting made me his assistant, and then from there on out I always
You always worked. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I never did an internship. I kind of learned as I went. I mean, I didn't know what else to do because I didn't know anyone when I moved to town, you know. And I'm not a country guitar player.
Well,
1998 downtown was full of, you know, honky tonks and Telecasters and chicken picking, and that was not my world.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because I know that you're not into that. What? So you came here looking for truly for recording opportunity. Well, I mean, because this is country.
I wanted to go out on the road. You know what? When I first came to Nashville in 98, I did not know what I was walking into. Because I remember when I first moved here, I think it took me a couple weeks to realize this is not Music City. You know, I thought Music City was going to be Music City. Hmm. But at the time, it was either country music. And country music now is 70s rock. Country music then was not
70s. Yeah, right. It was country music. Well, it was still not country music like in the 70s, but yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, Dan Huff hadn't changed the country music market yet with the bands he was producing, you know, yet. So, because I really think that market changed when he started, you know, working his way up the production, you know, the production ladder. But, you know, in hindsight being 2020, moving to Nashville in 98 was a big mistake. At the same, as a guitar player, at the same point, I landed, you know, a situation where I was able to start learning the production. And the production side benefited me greatly when I decided it was time to leave Nashville and get to Los Angeles. Because there was nothing here for me. Aside from, you know, I made good friends and I learned a lot. Nashville, I guess you could think of, was my college education.
Yeah. Gotcha.
The first time, because I live here now. But before I left Nashville, that was really, you know, what I would consider like my musical college education, because I got to sit in on some incredible sessions. And then I would take, you know, as I was assisting some of these guys, I would burn a cassette in the evening. I would take home that cassette and I would take home the chart, and I would reverse engineer what the guitar player was playing based on the chart, because I never went to music school.
Okay.
So I would figure out what he was playing, and I'd look at the chart and I'd be like, oh, okay. So when he was seeing this C major chord, he was playing this particular shape.
Okay.
Huh, interesting. Why did he do that? And it was really a backwards way. And in hindsight, I really should have gone to music school.
Yeah.
But it was a backwards approach. But then I really got into the production side, and I really enjoyed during that time the production side. I really got into, you know, Mutt Lange. I really started studying producers, and he was the guy that I just would always go back to. I'd dissect the albums that he produced. Now that I was learning, you know, the gear that people use making albums, you know. And so that was my trajectory. You know, I became a good guitar player during that time, because I was thrown into really some tough situations that I wasn't prepared for, but I really believed that I could succeed in. And sometimes I didn't succeed in them, but sometimes I did.
So, for example, like, what's something that you succeeded in as an example? So,
well, I started getting called to play lead guitar on a lot of like gospel albums. And you know, they would play with, you know, they'd have the guys playing all the gospel stuff, you know, the R&B-ish kind of tracks. And then I would be the guy showing up with a Mesa Boogie, you know, and ripping some Steve Lukather type of solo over that. And so those were things that put me in an interesting situation, because, you know, I'm reading these charts that are not necessarily diatonic, right? I mean, these charts are kind of weird. And so I really had to break out of the mold of just, you know, being a rock guitar player. You pick, you know, if you're playing in a song in E minor, your whole solo is based around E minor, right? And playing playing over some of this gospel stuff, I really had to stretch out. And even though I didn't have at the time the musical knowledge to know what I was doing, my ear was learning stuff. You know, my ear was learning over this chord. I need to hit this note. I would hear it in my head, and then I'd find it and hit it. And, so
but breaking down those solos had to help you hear tremendously.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot in the process. Again, like, I think my first 5 years in Nashville before I moved out to LA, my 5 years in Nashville was my college education. You know? I learned a lot about production. I learned a lot about playing guitar. I learned a lot about tones. You know, prior to this, I'd only played in rock bands, and I only played in my own bands. So where I was, you know, myself and the singer were the, you know, we were the songwriters. And, you know, when we went into, we made three records. When we go in to make a record, you know, it's like, this is my guitar tone that fits the songs that I wrote, you know. So I wasn't used to, you know, seeing someone else's vision to completion.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So you're here. And what prompted you to move to LA then?
Oh, God, I hated it. I hated Nashville. I hated it. I despised it. But I didn't really know what else to do. And I knew I needed to get more experience. I knew as a guitar player at the time, I wasn't ready to go out to LA. And I didn't really know, you know, I just felt kind of like I was in a good situation because I was working a lot. But I hated everything I was working on. It just wasn't my natural thing. And so, you know, what's interesting is during that time, during those 5 years that I was here, I was always writing songs, and I was always, you know, my hope at that point was like, well, maybe I can get a publishing deal. But so I would write all these pop songs and these rock songs, and I'd because I had these contacts at these studios, I'd go in and I'd make these great sounding recordings of them.
Like demos?
Not even demos. They were the first recordings, but they weren't demo quality. Because at that point, I learned how to run the console. I learned how to mic up a drum set. I learned how to get good guitar tones. So I was, you know, producing and engineering my songs. And I'd do this on downtime, you know, where I'd work, you know, do a favor for a buddy and get, you know, a day or two at the studio, whatever it was. So ultimately, as, you know, as I was going through these years, I was building up my own little catalog of songs. And again, I didn't really know how this was going to play out. My real goal was I was trying to get out on the road and tour.
Still?
Still, oh yeah. That's why I left Nashville, because I pigeonholed myself as a studio guy. So, and I couldn't break out of that. So finally, one day I just had enough, and I hopped in my car and I drove out to LA, and,
literally and I, like packed all your shit in the car.
I gave a friend of mine the majority of the stuff that I owned. She had just gotten her own place. I gave her, you know, like my kitchen and my, you know, my TV and my living room stuff and all that. And I had a SUV that I threw a two amps in. I think I had three or four guitars, threw my pedals in, and I had a suitcase of clothes and, you know, two black garbage bags full of clothes and an inflatable mattress. And I drove out to LA, and I knew one person in LA.
Wow.
And I ended up in Los Angeles. I was there with the intent that I'm going to find a road gig with a pop artist. And within a month, I was the guitar player on a TV show, my very first TV show. I got the job playing guitar on The Young and the Restless.
How'd you get that gig?
I ran the meeting with a guy at a with a composer. Just randomly met a composer.
That is so wild.
Who invited me up to hang at his house up in Malibu, and his next door neighbor is a guy named Hans Zimmer, very well known.
Yeah, why do I know that name? Okay.
Hans Zimmer has done so many blockbuster films, and like this guy had this incredible compound up in Malibu, and he did The Young and the Restless and The Bold and the Beautiful, and he hired me to start playing guitar on those, and so here I was, you know, less than a month and a half living in LA, and now I have a gig playing on these shows, and I immediately learned the difference between playing the cool thing is I'd go to his studio, you know, maybe two or three days a week, and he would get those scenes and I would watch him compose those scenes. He'd spend, you know, maybe, you know, 15, 20 minutes composing to the scene. Then he'd be like, all right, I want something like a funk part in D, you know, so I'd create a little funk part in D or whatever. And
was this challenging for you as a player?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, one of the very first times I ever was recording for him, I was recording some acoustic guitar for this one scene, and I was in the guitar booth. And of course, I'd been used to, you know, album world, where you play it perfectly, and if you don't play it perfectly, you pick up where you left off and continue playing it perfectly. And I was just strumming some chords, and I don't know what happened, but maybe I went from like a G to a C, and maybe, you know, maybe a string buzzed slightly. You know, and I stopped playing, and I said, let me just grab that from there. And he came in over the talkback and just annihilated me. He's like, don't you ever, you know, stop playing until I tell you to stop playing. He's throwing some profanities my way and yelling at me. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I'm going to get fired. I just made him so mad, you know? So I finished my part and I walked back into the control room and I told him, I said, man, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to stop. And he just stopped, you know, playback of the scene. He goes, Michael, we're not making records here. We're just capturing an emotion. This is going to sit so far below the dialogue. The goal of this music is to just, you know, propel the scene through to the next scene. And we have to do 13 or more of these today. So any little mistake, like unless it's drastic, no one's going to hear it. We're not making records. And that, I thought about that phrase for a long time. We're not making records here. You know, that's amazing. And I think this guy is writing so much music every day. And then all of this music is going to be heard in like 3 or 4 weeks. You know, and that made such a difference to me in that this he's getting so much music out there consistently, and it's not perfect, but it's buying.
And it's getting out there immediately.
Immediately. But on top of that, I'd hang out with him. We'd go get lunch and stuff like that up in Malibu, and we'd be driving down the street, and you know, and he'd be like pointing to some guy's house. That's so and so's place. He's the composer for this. This is some guy's place. That's the composer for this. And I'm looking at these palatial estates. I mean, you can't even fathom some of these places. And I'm thinking, I've never even heard of these guys. But then I'd look them up, and these guys were all composers, very successful, and it really started opening my mind to the idea of composing. This is interesting. But ultimately, because you asked me what my channel was that led me here, during that time, I started meeting music supervisors. These music supervisors were people that I didn't know what that role even meant.
This is in LA. You started meeting music.
Yeah, this is 2003 now, and I'd moved out there. And by the time I moved out there, I had about, you know, roughly 50 songs, you know, that were pop songs that, you know, couldn't get anyone's attention in Nashville. And I started meeting these music supervisors through working on, you know, these shows. And by the time I lived there a year, and I had all of my songs placed on shows. You know, I was getting played, you know, I was giving them songs. I talked to them, hey, can I give you some songs? Oh, I'd love to hear your songs. And I'd give them a CD of some songs. And 2 weeks later, they'd license one. And then they'd send me a check for, you know, more money than I would make in 2 or 3 months living in Nashville, producing records that I, you know, at the end of my time in Nashville, I was producing albums. I'd make more money on a sync fee than I made in a couple months in Nashville. And
so you were addicted after that.
Oh my gosh. And I thought, this is incredible. All my songs are getting used and all my songs are getting heard, and they were getting featured placements on big shows. And I thought, this is amazing. You know, this is so cool. You know, I'd have a, you know, I could call my buddies back in New York and my family and be like, hey, watch TV on Friday night. You're going to hear one of my songs, you know? And I thought, this is amazing. And I was starting to make good money.
Question, yeah. Do you still have a relationship with that guy who came in and yelled at you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I have not burned, to my knowledge, any bridge. he was, you know, I think his you know, sometimes during these shows, that wasn't the last time I've been yelled at, but it wasn't necessarily being yelled at because I was doing something wrong or bad. I think it was just the pressure. You know, when you're under pressure and you know, and you know you need to move on to the next thing quickly, matter of like going, dude, just hurry up. We just got to get this done. We got to move on, you know. And he wasn't like lighting into me, you know, too bad. But it was enough to throw me. I hadn't experienced that before. But I learned really quick that, again, you know, we're not making records here.
Right. I wrote that down, actually. That was a pretty compelling – that probably changed your life, that line.
I use that phrase all the time.
Yeah, Michael, we're not making records here.
We're not making records here. Yeah.
Which has been drastically different from all you've been doing when you were in Nashville, where everything was perfect, production, studio, blah, blah, blah.
And prior to that, up in Woodstock.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything I'd done up until that point was albums.
Okay. So how long were you doing that for before you said, I'm bored of this, I want to go play music again?
Well, I was always out there licensing. Like, I, you know, how I say I fell into it. Licensing was, I moved out to LA with the goal of finding a gig. I wanted to go out and tour the world with a pop artist. Mm. And licensing was just my way of not working at Starbucks.
Right.
And so from the beginning, it was always that. Now, it took a number of years until I really got real serious about it.
Why do you think you didn't pursue that right away early on? Because you still had this thing where I want
to
play.
I was in my 20s and I still wanted to go and tour the world. And so, I mean, I pursued it. I was very active in it. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that was very, I actively focused on it. At the same point, the first couple years was I spent a lot of time making a lot of mistakes and figuring out this world because I didn't have a mentor. I didn't have someone who showed me the ropes. You know, no one who really explained to me that world. I just, you know, dove in and spent a lot of time and money making mistakes and figuring things out. I'd make a mistake. Oh, this didn't quite work. I'd come back, you know, and then kind of, you know, make a slight change in my approach and then try that. And that worked a little better, but I'm sure it can, you know, I'm sure something can work even better. So I'd make a change in my approach. And then as I kept making those adjustments, you know, I was having more and more success. But at the same point during that time, I was still really active in you know, I was out in LA playing with different artists. I was playing all the clubs on the Sunset Strip and you know, really just trying to get my name out so I could finally land that big, you know, that big artist gig that would, you know, allow me to travel the world. But licensing was just kind of the thing that I fell into that allowed me to keep pursuing that path.
You mentioned like a second ago, I just wanted to ask you briefly about it. You said, I didn't have a mentor back then. Since that time, have you like actively sought out people to mentor in general?
Okay. So I had a mentor very early in my career. I had two of them. I had a mentor when I first came to Nashville and I first kind of got into the engineering production side of things. I had two incredibly successful. In fact, one of them, I think, just won his eighth Grammy last year. I think he won his eighth Grammy. But they're great friends of mine still to this day. They took me under their wing, and if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't have had the career that I have now. But when I moved to LA, you know, they were on the engineering production side. Of course, I was just trying to get out on the road, and then, you know, trying to figure out this licensing stuff, and so there was no one that I knew who, you know, during that time that really helped me with either of them. A lot of it was just I was just figuring out my own path, you know. But yeah, now I have someone that actually I it's a completely odd story, but I'll condense it into about 1 minute if I can. I got called last fall, maybe it was like September or so, to play guitar on a session for an album. Basically, I was fixing guitars. This producer friend of mine produced an album for this guy, and they didn't really like, I guess, what the original session guy gave them. So he brought it to my studio, and I replaced guitars on two songs. And he brought this particular artist with him. And I'm an avid reader, as you and I were talking a bit before the interview started. I read constantly, and I love reading. And anyway, he brought this guy in. This guy was from New Mexico, and you know, he had this cool voice. We were playing these very Beatles-esque kind of tunes that I was, you know, playing guitar on. And I turned around to him at one point. I said, are you singing? And he's like, yeah. I said, man, your voice is unbelievable. I love it. It's so cool. And he's like, oh, thank you. And at one point he said, I noticed you read a lot. And, oh yeah, I read a lot. And we kind of started talking about some books. And long story short is this was actually one of my favorite authors. And I had no idea. He was sitting in my studio and I was playing guitar on his album.
That is so funny.
His books. Oh, yeah.
You'll have to tell me afterwards who that was. That's amazing, man.
Well, then the story gets a little deeper, you know. So we start talking a little bit more, and this guy's had an incredible career, unbelievable career. And so, you know, as he leaves, he gives me his card. He goes, I'm heading back to New Mexico. I love, you know, what you played. I'm so happy. You know, man, feel free to reach out anytime. So about 2 weeks later, I sent him an email and I said, you know what? I'm kind of in another phase of my life right now. And you've done so many amazing things in your life. And this and that. I said, I've had two mentors in my past who changed my life greatly. And I actually sent him a message. I said, I would love it if you'd be willing to kind of mentor me into this next phase of my career. And he hopped on a plane and he flew back to Nashville, and we met up for lunch. We had like almost 4 hour lunch, and I've had an incredible friendship with him since. And it's just been phenomenal. So
that's,
yeah.
Awesome. What a good story, man.
Mentorships are, you know, incredible. I know that, you know, I've been mentoring a number of people, a lot of road guys who are trying to get off the road and you know, get into licensing so they can stay at home with their family and write music and get their songs out and be able to make a consistent income with it. And I love that aspect of it. And so it's been cool to actually be fed from the other side as well. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. What a good story, man. Wow.
Thanks.
Very good for you. Okay, so take me now to, you hook up with Paul Gilbert, I guess, is
sure. Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah. So how did that
okay,
whole thing
so, go? Yeah, and so, you know, when I was living in Nashville in the early 2000s, my very first record that I got hired to produce, I wanted to do something completely different. And having spent a lot of time in the recording studios with session guys, there's, you know, like three drummers and three guitar players and three bass players who play on everything. Mm. And I was just absolutely, because I came from band world, I was absolutely opposed to this.
Because when you have that, I'm thinking in your mind, everything sounds the same, because it has to, because you get the same guys.
Yeah, it's all the same guys. Yeah. I hate. Yeah. So I don't use session guys on anything I do.
Okay.
And no knock on session guys. I play on sessions for other people. I know a lot of them. I'm just not a fan of it. Hmm. And so I was talking to a buddy of mine, and I said, yeah, I need to find a good drummer for this particular album that I was producing, that I got hired to produce. And he goes, I have a friend of mine who just moved here from Oregon. You should meet him. Great drummer. And so I went and met him. And he's been my best friend since. His name's Jeff Bowders. And he spent a couple years playing with some artists in Nashville. And then in 2003, he moved out to L.A. And I ended up moving out to L.A. about 2 or 3 months after he did. And he and I were roommates the entire time I was living out there. Incredible drummer. In fact, I'm going to push something for him. He just released through Hal Leonard his, I think, his third or fourth drum book. But he, in 2005, I believe, or maybe in 2006, I don't remember exactly when it was, he and I were living in an apartment. We had a 3-bedroom apartment in Encino. And Paul had gotten his number, and Paul was looking for a drummer for a tour. And so Paul called Jeff. And Jeff became Paul's drummer. And through Jeff, I ended up meeting Paul. And then I ended up doing some production work on one of Paul's albums. I'm trying to think of the name of it. It's one of his solo albums.
Dude, I noticed you have some like the Who's Next up there, an old Aerosmith album, like Night in the Ruts. What is it?
Back there. Oh, I got Toys in the Attic.
Toys in the Attic. Yeah, what a great album.
Mahogany Rush, Frank Marino, Mahogany Rush Live.
Yeah, that I don't know, believe it or not. I've never checked.
You got
Frank Mahogany. I know. I have to check him out. It's on my
Frank Marino and Mahogany Rush, the
Frank
live.
Marino.
Incredible. And then I got up on the wall here in front of me. I got a bunch of other records. Yeah. But I'm trying to look back there because I have Paul's record up on the wall too. It's I gotta go look at it. Fuzz Universe. It's one of his solo albums called Fuzz Universe. You know, Paul knew I did some production work, and so I did quite a lot of the pre-production work on that record, and you know, just became very good friends with Paul, and then you know, was friends with him for quite a while, and then I got into playing guitar because of Paul Gilbert.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I picked up the guitar because in the summer when I was 12 years old, I was with my mom in North Carolina, and there was a Racer X Live Extreme Volume tape, you know, on the way out, coming out of a Piggly Wiggly or something that we were walking out of. And I asked her to buy it for me because it looked really cool. And I still remember taking that back to my grandparents' place and putting it up on the tape deck and listening to it. And my mind just went crazy, and I decided I had to play guitar. So I started playing guitar because of Paul. And you know, my decision to move out to L.A., in 2003 happened because just south of where I live now, they're building a road called 840, which is now connected, but at the time it wasn't. And you could get on 840 and you could just open up your car. And I just bought a brand new car at the time. And so, you know, I'd get on it and just haul. There was never any cops because it wasn't connected to either side of the, you know, the main, you know, I-40. And it was on my birthday that I decided I listened to a Paul Gilbert CD, one of his solo albums, Going One Way, and then I put a Richie Kotzen CD in on the other way, you know, heading back as I was meeting my buddy Jeff for my birthday and a couple other friends. And I decided then, I thought, you know, I got to be around the guys who inspire me. And those were the two guitar players that inspired me. So I decided that day that I was going to move to LA. And I think Jeff moved maybe like a couple weeks later because he had gotten off the road and wanted to go out there. And he'd gone to Musicians Institute. And so he wanted to get back there. And I followed like, I don't know, three months later or something, 3-4 months later. But anyway, he got the gig with Paul. And so I started working with Paul, became friends with him. And then in 2009, Mr. Big was doing a reunion tour, and Paul just called me up one time and said, hey, you know, we're doing this, you know, big, Japan tour. We're going to be on these big stages and I need someone to run my pedal board. You know, would you love to do it? And I thought, absolutely. I play guitar because of these guys.
Yeah.
So absolutely. And one of the highlights for me as a guitar player was, yeah, I grew up in a small town. I learned how to play guitar because of the old Intense Rock, you know, videos that Paul would release. That's how I learned, you know, all those old REH videos. And Paul did an instructional video I'm trying to think, it may have been like the Get Out of My Yard instructional video that he released, where he did this thing with the human capo. And I ended up playing guitar with him, being the human capo on his video. And so like that was a big moment for me because I started playing guitar because of him, and I learned how to, my whole style is based around, you know, the stuff he taught back then. And so now to be on a video with him, I think that was probably like 2007 when he released that or something like that. And that was a big moment. I thought that's pretty freaking cool.
So I give you credit though, because you had, you know, you could have easily said, man, I'm not going to be a guitar tech because I'm been, I produce records in the studio. I've done this, that. I've got licensing shit going. You know, and you could have easily said that, but that you didn't do it, again, changed the your fortunes.
Yeah, you know, that was, first off, I mean, that's a once in a lifetime opportunity, you know?
Right.
And they were the band that, you know, they were my band growing up. And so I couldn't turn that down, and just to be able to meet the other guys in the band, you know, oh my gosh, how amazing would this be? And to go to Japan, I mean, that'd be
right,
amazing.
Which is even cooler, yeah.
Yeah, and then we went to Indonesia and whatnot. And then after the Indonesia tour, they continued on. They did Europe and I think India and all that other stuff. And but I had too many things going on back in LA, so I actually bailed at that point. But I got to experience, you know, a month out on the road with them, which was incredible. But the cool thing from that was I learned, you know, when I was over there, they're like the Beatles of Japan. You know, people show up at the airport for them, you know, when they know they're coming into town, or they follow them to the train station after a show. Like, you know, it's you have to go through this mass of people just to get into the hotel, you know, because it's just incredible. And I remember thinking, this is the ideal gig, a gig where you can go overseas and you can be this huge rock star. And then you can go back to America and you can go to the local grocery store and no one cares who you are. No one bothers you. And I remember coming back from that experience, I thought, that's the goal, you know, to where you can do whatever you want in America and live your life and then have your other life overseas, you know. And but how am I going to accomplish that?
So let me ask you this. You've mentioned goals, mentoring, things like that several times. Did you get clued on to stuff like this when you grew up? Like, where did you get turned on, like goal setting or having goals even? That's not something that just randomly happens. You have to either, somebody has to turn you on to it, or you have to intersect with that concept. Where did all that shit happen for you?
I did that from a very young age.
Based on what?
I have no idea.
Wow.
I think just the fact that I was always an intensely shy individual. I think, you know, that's another thing when we think of like, when I think of Nashville, my 5 years in Nashville, when I came down to Nashville in 98, I could not have a conversation with someone unless it revolved around, you know, Eddie Van Halen, Randy Rhoads, or Paul Gober, right? if we were not discussing these three guitar players, then I just couldn't have a conversation with you because I didn't know what else to have a conversation about. And I remember when I left.
Are you an only kid? Are you an only child?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
But I remember when I left New York, my mother even said to me, she goes, Michael, you sure you can do this? And I said, yeah, I can. I said, why? And she goes, you know, to be successful in the music industry, you need to, you know, you need to be able to get out there and you know, you're
shake hands, kiss babies.
Yeah. So I think in hindsight, when I look back at my first 5 years in Nashville, a lot of it was breaking through that barrier and realizing that, you know, I'm not a shy individual. I just practiced being shy through my teenage years, you know? And I think I realized that I'm just by nature, I'm not shy, but through my teenage years, I always wrote out my goals, you know, probably I didn't know how to express them any other way. I wouldn't go and talk about them with someone. So I'd write them out and I always continued doing that. And I worked backwards. You know, if I created a goal, if my goal was, I want to have an album, you know, released by, you know, August, then I have to have the album, you know, in mastering by the third week of July, which means that the album has to be mixed by the first week of July, which means I have to have, you know, the studio booked for the first week of June and just work backwards.
Right,
I have to have
right.
songs done by the end of May, you know?
That's great. I mean, that's fantastic that you like just did that on your own. It really unusual. I think it's very unusual.
It probably is, but I think a lot of it just stemmed from, you know, again, being intensely shy and being I internalized a lot of things, you know, so
writing them down was your way of communicating them to yourself, maybe even.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
man,
yeah.
I give you a lot of credit. That's really cool. And you know, it's funny that you said you're intensely shy. Like from the first conversation we had, I'm like, oh, this guy's going to be a great interview. He don't shut up. And I meant that in a good way, you know, like not like he doesn't shut up and he rambles on about nothing, but like, man, he's got, this is perfect. You know, we'll have dialogue.
One of the things I've learned is that, you know, like I said, I learned that I wasn't shy. I just practiced shy. I practiced being shy all through high school.
Why?
unknowingly. Why?
Just being high school teenage insecurity, probably.
Yeah, high school teenage, yeah, insecurity. I've always, I was a later. I developed a little later, I've always been, so when I was a freshman in high school, I looked like I probably should have been in seventh grade, or something like that.
You didn't know that would be a good thing one day.
Yeah, I know, right? but those kinds of things, you get to high school and, you're this little shrimp, 80 pounds, and you got other kids who are in your same grade who are, 140 pounds and, can play on a big sports team.
Yeah.
And, you could become the ball, basically, because you're that small. So it probably started from that. And then, I don't know. I think I just got very into music, and music was that escape. I mean, I don't have any, negative attitudes towards my youth by any means. But right. I think that I just practiced it. I fell into that, and then I just got into the practicing of it. And then that's what I just used that maybe as an excuse. Well, I'm just very shy, whatever. But you can't be shy.
Yeah. So then that became, okay, I get you. Then that justified your behavior or your awkwardness. So it wasn't awkward. It was legit.
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool.
But I think the reality for a lot of people is, when people tell me like, oh, I'm OCD, I don't always believe that. I think, well, you might not be. You're just practicing it. You're practicing that right now. And if you decided that you didn't want to be OCD, then you could also practice not being OCD, therefore you can't be OCD.
I agree with you on that, because I think you are what you want to be, and there are some people who are legit, whatever. But even if you're legit, whatever. You can work really hard to get on the edge of that so that you're mentally not that anymore. And you know what I'm saying?
It can be used as an excuse. Well, man, I can't sit down and practice because I'm ADD. No, you can sit down and practice if you decide to sit down and practice.
Yeah, right. You're choosing not to. And now you got a legit reason why.
Yeah.
In quotes.
Yeah. Is that a legit reason why you're giving yourself an excuse to practice being ADD?
Yeah.
Yeah. There are people who are shy. But I look back now and I realize that I wasn't shy. I just practiced being shy through my youth.
Good for you, man. Okay. So you go out on the road with Paul.
Which, by the way, I have to stop you. I let you guys know that, that was one of the highlights of my life.
Really?
Because I grew up with posters of these guys on my wall. And, as much as, all those guys in that band are incredible musicians, but on a scale of 1 to 10, if their musicianship is considered like a 25, then as human beings, each of them is 125.
That's awesome.
They are unbelievable human beings. Every one of them. I've become really good friends with all of them over the years. And Billy, in fact, just moved down the street from me here in town. And, I still stay in contact with Paul. I saw Eric and saw Pat, in December and, chatted with Eric back in the summer. And each one of them is an incredible human being. So I love that they're so successful as players, because they're as human beings, they're amazing people.
But haven't you found that most of the time, the guys that are really successful are really nice, genuine, kind people?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah. I mean, that's not that's more the norm. I mean, sure, you always have the guy, this guy's a dick, and in spite of being a huge dick, he somehow became successful. Or the even rarer situation where, people say, when you become successful, money changes you. I have found that that's not necessarily the case. It's more like, money amplifies more of what you are. Like, if you're a nice person before, now you have money, you're probably nicer. If you're kind of an asshole and you have money, now you're a bigger asshole.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you.
Yeah. But I have found most of the successful people I've met in business and now here are extremely, the kind of people I would go out with my wife and have dinner with, or hang out with them and have a drink or coffee or smoke a cigar without even thinking about it.
Well, I can tell you from my own experience that in the world I've lived in, sometimes the people that I work with are not the most talented people.
Right.
But they're the most amazing human beings. And that's the reason why they get the right work that they get. I have three phrases that I have lived by for a long time. And one of them is attitude determines altitude. You know, and I tell people all the time, I am not the greatest guitar player by any stretch of the imagination. I'm not even the best songwriter by any stretch of the imagination. But I think the thing that has allowed me to succeed in the part of the music industry that I've chosen to succeed in, which is really the writing for TV and placements, is because I really have an attitude of being a service to the people I work for. Whether that be the music supervisors or the music editors or whatever. I want my music to make their lives – I want the process of licensing my music for them to be an easy process. And I want when they work with me, I want to make their life as easy as possible, right?
No, go ahead. I apologize. Go ahead.
So I think that, like, you know, you see that too with a lot of very successful people. They're successful because they have a great attitude, you know, and that determines how high they get in their career.
Well, you're in the service business. You're not thinking, oh, I'm an artiste. Here's my stuff. And you're looking at, you're thinking, hey, I'm in the service business. You have a need. I have a potential solution and I hope we can make these match.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And people forget that music is the service business.
Music is a service business if you're the artist.
Yes.
If you're the artist, you're the one up on stage. Your job is to communicate an emotion and to entertain people. And that's a service. You're bringing people to – you're giving people some emotional experience, right? And that's the service that you're bringing to them. I think one of the reasons why a lot of artists, you know, fail is because their approach is wrong. They have the look at me mentality, go listen to my song mentality. Well, why don't you tell me why? Why should I listen to it? Yeah. What's it going to do for me? If I know what it's going to do for me, you know, what I'm going to get out of it, then I'll put the time in and listen to it, you know, and then I'll put the time in and I'll go see your concert or I'll buy your album.
They need a USP. My music does this for that and makes you feel like that. What's your other two expressions? You said attitude determines altitude. What's the other two?
Attitude determines altitude is one that I love. One that I think is fantastic is your true worth is determined by how much more value you give than what you receive in payment. Mm-hmm. And the idea of that is, you know, always over deliver, go the extra mile. You know, I can tell you one of the reasons why I was successful when I first got out to Los Angeles playing guitar on sessions for some of these composers I started working for was not because I was an amazing guitar player by any means at all. It was because I brought a lot more to the table. You know, whether that be, you know, you also keep in mind that 2003 Pro Tools was still fairly new. You know, now I'd gotten really skilled at Pro Tools, but I remember a bunch of the composers that I started working for were fairly new to the medium. And I remember, you know, being on sessions and they were trying to, you know, like move MIDI and just kind of frustrated with, you know, like they can't copy and paste their MIDI or whatever their issue was. And I'd always just get up quickly and be like, what are you trying to do? Oh, I'm trying to move this. Okay, well, we got to set this into a block mode. We got to grab this, copy and paste it and move it over here. And just changing the modes. Like I over-delivered when I showed up. They didn't pay me to engineer. But then I would sometimes take on the role of engineering that session.
So you had some value added stuff, which got you the job.
Yeah. So always adding value, you know, no matter what you do, you know, one of the great compliments I got was from a composer, friend of mine, his name is Matteo Messina, and he's a very good friend of mine, but very successful composer. And one time we were in his studio working on, I don't know if it was a movie or a TV show he was doing or whatever, but I remember at one point he just stopped and he goes, Mike, the reason I love working with you is because you approach your guitar playing like a producer. And I thought, well, that's cool. Good. Because, you know, you're not just hiring me to show up and be a monkey and play the notes that you're writing out for me. You're hiring me to actually like create something with you that's going to tell a story in the end, you know? So yeah, I think I always just approach it with give more. You know, always give more, even though you're only paying me for this.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, for sure. And what's the third? Well, the thing is, since most people don't even do what you're paying them for, and you're doing more, it's like you get called back a second and a third, and a, you know, and then you get referred out, and it's just there's no doubt. There's only upsides, infinite upsides to doing that.
If you want job security. figure out what you do and what you can bring to the table and bring that to the table all the time. Mm. You know, some people are like, oh, they don't pay me for this. I hear that a lot from musicians. They don't pay me for this. You know, for some guys, you know, loading in his gear or something like that or whatever. It's like, oh, I don't get paid enough to do this or whatever. Well, actually, you know, if you had a better attitude, you might actually get more gigs. Mm. You know, that is your job. Your job is to do, you know, is to bring more to the table, more value to the table. Now, if you don't like the job, quit it.
Right.
Quit it and move on and shut up.
Right.
Right. But if you're actually going to show up and do the job, then you show up and you bring everything you can. Right. There's no excuse. Either you dig it or you don't. If you don't, then do something else.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Man. By the way, the guys I know in Nashville, and I know you know a lot of these same guys that have that attitude, there's a reason why they've been first call guys for, you know, 20 years, maybe even.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, people want to work with the people who they like. You know, the reality is most modern music, you can play guitar for 3 or 4 years and you can play most stuff that's out, you know, that you have to. Right. It doesn't require, you know, 25 years of playing guitar to play the stuff that you hear on the radio.
You don't need to be Paul Gilbert. Yeah.
No, no. I mean, that's a whole other, I mean, that he's on him and guys like Vi. And I mean, those guys are on a completely different planet. But for the majority of the stuff that you listen to on the radio, you know, you play guitar for a couple years, you can play that. Hmm. Right. But the reality is that people want to work with people who they like, you know, it's the music industry, people want to be surrounded by people who they enjoy being around. They want to be around people who inspire them in some other way. And they might even want to be around people who push them to become better artists and musicians themselves.
Absolutely.
Right? But when you show up with a negative attitude or the, you know, I'm not going to do that because they don't pay me. Well, I mean, that's a surefire way to kind of, you know.
Never get asked back.
Yeah, yeah. We're just kind of, you know, you wonder sometimes. I've seen it through my career. I've seen people who were very successful go from being very successful to not being able to get work at all. And they are great players.
Wow.
Had nothing to do with their playing. Had everything to do with their attitude. You know, and I've seen that firsthand.
That sucks. So,
yeah, but, you know, I mean, I always throw it back. You know, I'm an average guitar player, but I'm I think I bring a lot more to the table. You know.
What's your third expression that you say?
Be a service, not a narcissist. You know, it's just true. I mean, these are all kind of very much based on the same thing. You know.
Yeah.
I think you.
Give instead of focus on solve. It's funny, when my wife became a realtor about 3 years ago, she, for a long time before that, took care of the back ends of whatever businesses I had and was raising our kids. And she first started working, and she never did sales, but she was obviously being around me and running a marketing company for 20 years. She knew about sales. And I told her one thing when she started, because she was really eager to get this one deal. And I said, babe, listen, just focus on solving problems, because you being eager, that's your problem. Don't make that your client's problem. All you got to do is focus on giving them solutions. And I give her credit, much probably because, you know, we're both older. She was like right away, and, you know, she's done really well, and she's always kept that in mind. And that's all you got to do, man. Focus on helping people, giving them solutions to their problems, whatever they're having, you know, and things generally fall into place career-wise for you.
Yeah, no matter what you're doing musically, your job is always to help see the other person's vision through. So if I'm playing guitar for someone, an artist, my job is to see their vision through. If I'm playing guitar on a project for a producer, it's to see the vision through. If I'm writing music that's going to get placed on a TV show, that music is there to see the director or producer's vision through.
I'm totally.
Right? That's all we're doing.
So you grew up in Woodstock. Did you say you had a sister?
Brother.
You had a brother. Yeah. Did he go into music?
No, there's no one musical in the family.
Nobody. What did your folks do? What kind of jobs did your parents have?
My mom stayed at home and took care of us until we were old enough, and then she became the office manager of a radio station.
Oh,
and
that's
then,
a cool job.
Then my dad worked for IBM.
Everybody worked for IBM up there at some point in time, right?
That's the entire community.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm up until like 93.
Yeah, when they moved. Okay, what are some of the bigger obstacles that you've had to deal with throughout this journey, whether it be personal, music-related, or business-related? Probably understanding and overcoming, to me, the shy thing seemed like a pretty good one that you conquered.
That was probably the biggest one.
Yeah.
You know, of course, there's always going to be people who are going to tell you you can't do it and this and that, you know, but you just got to ignore those people. I think for me, my biggest obstacle was overcoming being shy and learning that, you know, I'm actually not shy. You know, when I got that idea out of my mind, it's amazing how I suddenly became able to find myself in a situation and have a conversation with anyone about anything.
Good for you, man. That's awesome. Flip sides now. Have you at any time, if you can go back and look, said, man, there's a couple of mistakes I made and here's what I learned from them. And what were those mistakes and what were the lessons?
The mistakes that I made were early in my career, my late teens, early 20s. And I would say that the biggest mistake, I'm 42 now, so I can say it being older. And the biggest mistake I ever made in my life was spending 6 years in college.
Wow. That's a pretty bold admission. Why is that? It didn't get you anywhere?
It was a mistake at the time. I knew it was a mistake at the time. I knew it was a mistake the entire time. I knew it was just an absolute waste of time.
This was at Albany, SUNY Albany?
I went to Albany, and then I ended up, I finally graduated from SUNY New Paltz.
That's way the hell upstate, isn't it? That's like
SUNY New Paltz is south.
Okay,
south.
Okay. Yeah. So why was it a mistake? Just what did you major in there? Or?
Business. Yeah, business because it's the easiest major.
Yeah. So it was a mistake because there was nothing there for you. Like,
yeah, I knew that it was a waste of time. It's one of those things where everyone says, you know, like, oh, you got to have a backup plan. You got to have a backup plan. And at that point in my life, you know, I just wasn't, you know, I mean, I take responsibility for it because I was an adult. I was over 18. But the reality is I wasn't mentally confident enough yet. You know, I was playing in bands at the time and whatnot, but I wasn't confident because I'd heard, you know, growing up in that, you know, environment, which would be like the, you know, that part of New York where everyone's parents worked for that particular company, you know, you got to have a backup plan. You got to have a backup plan. You know, what are you going to do if music doesn't work out? And so for me, music not working out was never an option.
Okay.
So the idea of a backup plan was just to make them shut up,
gotcha.
You know? But after hearing that for so many years, you're thinking, well, I guess I got to have a backup
plan. I need a backup plan. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I still don't know what that backup plan is. But to me, I always wanted to go out to Musicians Institute. I always wanted to go to music school. In hindsight, my career's worked out great.
Right.
But in hindsight, my biggest regret and mistake was going to college and not going to music school. Because the second I graduated college, I left New York
to go play music in Nashville.
I arrived in Nashville the day after I graduated college.
Wow, good for you. That speaks volumes.
Literally the next day, that next morning, I got in the car and drove, and I got into town that night. Drove straight through. You know, a backup plan was never the idea for me. But the thing is I put myself in situations at a young age, you know, that, you know, some of them, like I said earlier in our conversation, some of them I failed at. And I failed at them because I didn't have the music knowledge.
Yeah.
And so in hindsight, still, that's my biggest regret. I wish I could have gone to music school and not wasted the time in school. And, you know, by the way, 6 years just to answer what might be the next question. It's 6 years because I failed. I dropped out and then I failed multiple times because I hated college.
Wow. So you had the universe telling you every which way.
Yeah.
But loose. So yeah.
I failed semesters. I dropped out semesters. So it took me a lot longer to get that 4-year degree because I just hated
it. Yeah, it clearly wasn't an intellectual like issue.
I would hope not.
Yeah, yeah. But now you're a bright guy, man. you could pass a marketing class, I'm pretty confident. Even marketing too, and business too.
Maybe. I don't know statistics, but maybe the other ones I could.
Statistics was interesting.
That was a tough class. Statistics class, by the way, took me 4 times to finally get like a D so I could move on to, you know.
To statistics too?
Well, at the time, you know, the business major, I think we only had to have one. Maybe we had to have two. I don't remember. I took statistics class so many times because I failed it so many times. That was the worst class. Oh my gosh. It was awful. I just never made sense to me.
See, I was like a math nerd when I was a kid, so I'd love that. Which is really weird, yeah. Okay, so if you can go back and give advice to your younger self, it would have been don't go to college, just do it.
I would have been like at 18, get in that little 1985 Honda Prelude of yours and drive across to Los Angeles. That's what I would have done.
Okay.
That's the advice I would give myself. I do have an interesting story about how I did get my
top. That's what I was just going to ask you. Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah. Do you want to start that question so you have something to cut in?
Yeah, well, let's do this. Let's do this. Talk about your go-to guitars, the top three, and then talk about if you have any cool or interesting stories behind how you got any of them.
So the top three guitars right now, yeah, I do have a cool story for each of them, as a matter of fact.
Awesome.
The top three guitars, electric guitar is a Schecter PT Custom, which is their – the PT stands for Pete Townsend, and it's their Telecaster model. And then I have an acoustic guitar called the McPherson.
Yeah. A lot of people tell me they're wonderful.
Been playing McPherson since 2005. I think I was the third person in Los Angeles to have one. And then my third guitar, the third top, I have about 40 guitars.
Wow.
This one is a shock to most people. It's an Epiphone.
No, I'm not surprised depending upon how old it is.
Okay, no. It's a reissue. It's a reissue of the 1962 Crestwood.
What's a Crestwood?
It's basically like a SG.
Okay.
Okay. And so when I first came to Nashville, I ended up meeting a guy named Richard Akers, who is the designer for Epiphone. And I ended up playing with a guy for a while, and so Richard would give me some guitars to take out, And I ended up getting this one Epiphone that I really liked. It just looked really cool. It looked really, really cool. Well, it started to go back in time, not to keep bringing up Paul, but I was at Paul Gilbert's studio one time. I think when we were working on the Fuzz Universe album, and he was talking about how back in the Racer X days, they used to play these old Epiphone Wilshires. Okay. And then they'd paint them like pink and green and this and that. This is before the Ibanez endorsement. And then, so when I connected with Richard, I asked him about the Wilshire, and he gave me one. Mm. So I had a Wilshire, and it was actually a really cool guitar. And then that spawned a conversation about the Crestwood. And so I got that. I use that on every TV show, every soundtrack. It's a studio guitar. I use it on everything. It is that with this particular Dumble profile that I have on my Kemper is unbelievable.
What year is that guitar, that Epiphone?
It's the reissue. They made it probably probably 5 or 6 years ago. They made 1,902 of them.
So it's pretty new.
It's new, yeah.
That is amazing.
And amazing. And I love it. Now, I don't take that thing out on the road. It doesn't leave my studio. But it's a great guitar for recording. And it's the guitar that I use for all the extra little like jangly parts.
Do you have it there, like handy? Or is it?
I can grab it. It's in the closet.
Yeah, let me check that out.
Pretty cool looking.
So it's got like a...
It's got the mini buckers on it.
A mini buckers Bigsby, you know, an Epiphone Bigsby.
Yeah. Yeah. They call it like the I forgot what they call it, but it's such a cool guitar. You know, it's basically the recreation of the actual 1962 model. Now this with like some clean guitar and some nice delay, you know, with the little, you know, tremolo on it. Oh, it's incredible. It keeps the intonation wonderfully, especially when you're using the tremolo on it.
I like those. It's not dots and it's not squares. It's like oval.
Yeah, it's like these ovals.
Yeah, I've never seen. It looks like a space age guitar. I've literally never seen that.
I have a lot of friends who come to my studio and they play like guitars. I tell all of them, like, you know, and I know Epiphone doesn't always have the best name.
Right, right.
But, I have a lot of guys play it, and some of the guys, like, they play it and they just can't put it down. And it's just a gem of a guitar. I'm so thankful that I have this one, but it has appeared on so many recordings.
That's so cool.
That's the story on that one. But the story on the Schecter is really cool. The Schecter. I was at my buddy Paul's, a guy named Paul Allen here in town, and he has a studio down at SIR. And probably about 2.5 years ago, I was just down there talking to him, and it was probably around 10 o'clock at night. And he has like 6 or 7 Schecters in their cases, you know, along his wall. And I mentioned something. I didn't know much about Schecter at the time. And I said, you have a lot of the pointy guitars. and he's like, oh, man, no, you got to try some of these. So he pulled out some of these Schecters, and he has a incredible guitar collection. But I started playing some of these, and I pulled out this hollow body. It's a semi-hollow body that I really dug, and I just kept gravitating back to that one. And he goes, man, you like that? I said, yeah, it's cool. Like, I wasn't really sold on it. I was just like, it's cool. He goes, well, why don't you take it home and play with it for a couple of days and just, you know, let me know what you think. I thought, well, yeah, it doesn't hurt. So I left his studio probably around, you know, 10:30. And about 5 minutes into my drive, I got a phone call from a composer friend of mine out in L.A. who was working on a TV show, and he had a last-minute delivery that had to go in. So he calls me, says, Mike, are you free to play on 16 scenes tonight? And I thought, oh, God, it's just going to be a late night. But I said, yeah. So I said, I'll be home in, you know, about 20 minutes. So about 20 minutes later, I got home. I downloaded all the files from my Dropbox, loaded them up into Pro Tools, and gave my buddy a call, and we started talking about the different scenes, kind of what he wanted. And around 5 o'clock in the morning, I finished all 16 scenes. But I used that particular guitar on 12 of them. So no big deal. You know, I got usage out of it. The next morning, I get a text message from – I slept in, of course. So I get a text message from the composer. It's probably the next afternoon. And he says, incredible job. The guitar tones, the clean guitar tones are unbelievable. What did you use? So I thought it was very interesting. So I took a screenshot of that and sent it to my buddy Paul, who I guess then sent it to his guy over at Schecter, who then responded back to him and said, tell Mike to pick out a guitar, to look through the guitars and see what he wants. So I went through
their website. Wow, very cool.
I went through their website and I saw the Telecaster. And I, of course, at this point now, I've been traveling back and forth to China a little bit. So I thought, well, I'll get a guitar that's just going to be my China guitar, you know, just something. Because you know, that travel gets pretty brutal.
Yeah.
So that's what I initially got it for. I thought, well, this will just be a throwaway guitar. You know, if it breaks overseas, you know, no big deal. I mean, I hate to say it like that, but I really wrote it off as like, well, yeah, I'll take it. You know, I'll take some, you know, it'll be my China guitar.
But you got to bring – you have to have that attitude about some guitar.
Yeah.
I mean
– well, that guitar is incredible. They put before they sent it out to me, they customized it. They put, you know, they sent it to the shop and, you know, did a bunch of custom things to it, and it has the Pasadena custom shop pickups in it, and it's incredible. That's my main guitar. It's my go-to guitar for everything, for
that's
live
so
stuff.
Cool.
That guitar has been around the world, and it's beaten. You know, I mean, there are so many chips and dings that are taken out of the back of it. But that guitar is incredible. It's an incredible – it plays amazing. It sounds amazing. The fact that it stays in tune – I played a New Year's Eve show last year in China where it was around America degrees was – or Fahrenheit degrees was below freezing. It was free. I was so cold. And we did – we went on stage around like right after the New Year hit. So we actually hit downbeat at like 12:02.
And this is outdoors, assumingly.
It's outdoors, you know, probably like 15, 20,000 people freezing. I'm wearing 4 layers of clothes. I can't even feel my fingers anymore. That guitar stayed in tune the entire show. It's mind blowing.
Wow, that is pretty bizarre.
Yeah. And then the story with the McPherson was 2005. I was sitting at a Starbucks in Sherman Oaks, California. Maybe it's Van Nuys. I don't know what part that's really considered. But my buddy Michael Nomad Rapole came up. And he, I think, at that time had the American Idol gig. And he had 3 McPhersons. McPherson gave him 3 guitars. And I think he was just looking to store it somewhere because, you know, space is at a premium out in L.A. And he stopped by. And this is the funny thing is for years I'd wanted a Taylor deal. And I had the month before just gotten a Taylor deal. Taylor gave me a 914 CE and like an 856 12 string. So two of their high-end acoustic guitars. And Michael brings this guitar by and he goes, hey, can I just leave this with you for a little bit? And I was like, yeah, it's fine. So so he's gone. I have this guitar now that's now in my possession. I get called to do a session. I play acoustic guitar. So I brought my Martin. I brought both Taylors. And I thought, well, what the heck? I'll bring this, you know, guitar with the funny looking sound hole. And that's what we used the entire session. And I kept wanting to use my Taylors. I was so proud of these things.
Because you got endorsement.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Producer's like, nah, man, no, that McPherson, that sounds incredible. So long story short, about 2 or 3 months later, I ended up returning the Taylors because I knew I would never play them again. Because
oh, wow. I'm
such a McPherson.
Thanks for the endorsement. No, thanks.
I know. Right. That didn't go over so well.
No, I'm sure. Yeah. But that being said, it would have gone over worse if you got this endorsement deal and you're playing McPherson guitars.
I mean, McPhersons are like a Maserati and Taylors are like a Mercedes.
Mm.
You know, they're still great guitars, but I mean, so I played Michael's McPherson for about 2 years. And in 2007, I got a gig on a weekly show on CBS every Friday night. And I was playing a heavy acoustic guitar on it. And I ended up sending an email to the president of McPherson at the time and just said, hey, I'm Michael Elsner. I've been using Nomad's guitar for the last 2 years. It's appeared on all these different films and all these different projects. But right now I'm playing guitar on this show on CBS and, you know, one of these days I'm going to buy one of your guitars, but if you can use this in any way to help promote your brand, you know, they're still fairly new. The company started in 2003.
So you basically gave him a really good testimonial from an active professional user.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He called me, like a couple of days later and we talked for like an hour on the phone. And I think he called me like a week later and we talked for another hour on the phone. And like a week or two later, he calls me, goes, hey, what's your address? And I told him my address. I said, why? And he goes, Matt McPherson, that's the owner of McPherson. He goes, Matt and I talked and we just feel like you've done so much to promote the brand without even owning one. So one just came off the line, you know, that we feel was going to go to a store, but we feel that it would be better in your hands. It's exactly what you're looking for.
Wow.
So they sent it to me. Yeah.
That's so cool.
My three guitars.
Those are good stories. And you know what? If I remember correctly, Rapol said his favorite guitar, he included a McPherson in his list. I'm almost positive of it because I think that might have been one of the first times I've heard of a McPherson.
Well, I travel when we go overseas. I travel with the Schecter. I have another Schecter now as well. But I still travel with that PT Customs, the real deal. And then I take one of the McPherson carbon fiber guitars for the acoustic stuff. So, and the singer that I play with over there, the artist, he also has the McPherson carbon fiber because with the travel that we do over there, he had actually his old Martin got destroyed on one of our last trips.
That sucks.
Yeah. So, last trips, I mean, last year sometime, it came back and it was in a couple of different pieces. So, yeah. So we travel with the McPherson carbon fibers and then, of course, the Schecter.
Awesome, man. Good stories. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Talk about, do you have any heroes? You've talked about a lot of mentors.
Heroes? I mean, guitar wise, you mean?
Anyway, it could be good. No, I really meant more like people that have, you know, inspired you in some way maybe or helped you become the person you are today. If that's guitar related, so be it. If it's not, so be it.
You know, honestly, I think my heroes would probably be my very close friends. I've been very fortunate in that my favorite drummer and my favorite bass player in the world are my very close friends.
That's awesome.
You know, and I've been able to make a lot of music with them and over the years. And aside from them just being unbelievably talented players, they're amazing human beings. When I lived in Los Angeles, I worked with a number of guys who were, you know, very well established, who, you know, took me under their wing and taught me a lot and, you know, gave me opportunities. So still very good friends with them, but on top of the fact that they're very talented musicians, they're amazing human beings. Mm. You know, they're the guys that you just love going out and having dinner with because you're always learning something from them and they're feeding something into your life that, you know, it's more important than just, you know, scales and guitar.
Yeah.
You
know? No, I know it, whenever you're with somebody that, like, when your energy, you know, when you have an interaction and your energy level is greater at the end of that, that's like a good deal, I think. You know,
absolutely.
That's a good barometer for me anyway.
Yeah, you know, there are two types of people. You have people who are like, you know, time suckers. You know, they just take and take and take and take. And then you have opportunity feeders. You know, people who they give you, even if it's not necessarily they're giving you opportunities, throwing opportunities your way, they're inspiring you to go out and create opportunities.
Right. They're putting something in your head that's either a challenge or an inspiration. Yeah, I totally get it, man. I'm totally with you. What's your best childhood memory, Mike? Besides college statistics class.
Ah, memory. Man, that's a great question. You know, honestly, there's not one because I had a great childhood. I grew up in a great town. It was rich in musical history. I had a really good youth. I was very fortunate. I had good parents, you know. So I had so much freedom in the sense that, you know, Woodstock is, it's up in the mountains and it's beautiful. And, you know, we could get on our bikes and we could ride and be gone all day long and not worry about, you know, bad people doing bad things to us. You know what I mean? So I grew up in a really nice town. I have a lot of great memories growing up.
Is there anybody or anything you miss from your childhood?
You know, I don't know. Let me, I'm thinking now, if I could say probably my childhood memory, what age would be the cutoff for that?
Man, I don't know. I consider childhood like, you know, anything under 18, really. It's kind of childhood. Depends on, you know, how nostalgic you are.
I don't necessarily. I think, you know, I have great memories. You know, my first car was a 1968 Pontiac. When I got it, it was a piece of crap. It was green and rusted. And I spent 6 months with my buddy Joe, and we restored it, you know, and, you know, did a lot of Bondo and fiberglass work to it and put a spoiler on the back. And it's basically it's a 68 Le Mans, which is the same body as a GTO and a Tempest. It's just a smaller engine. But that car, driving around town in that car and the freedom, hanging with my buddies, going to band rehearsals, you know, in our basements. That's such a great memory. You know, I love that. I love thinking back to those times.
That's awesome. Sounds like a lot of fun. Is there anything you miss from your childhood, whether it's something or someone?
I think the thing I probably missed the most of my youth was just, you know, the exploration, you know, being, you know, 14, 15 years old, hanging out in all our basements, playing music and discovering music, you know, and discovering new things that we could do. Or, you know, we'd be working on a song, trying to learn some cool hair metal band song, you know, and being able to play it the next week. And then it sounded good because there was always two guitar players, you know, and so he could play one part, I could play another. And I think I missed the freedom of just getting into a basement with a drummer, a bass player, and another guitar player and just jamming, you know, and exploring, you know, this newfound world of music that we had at our fingertips.
They have basements in Nashville, don't they?
Sometimes.
Yeah. No, because we don't have them here in Florida. That's why I was asking.
It depends on the house. It depends if it's built on a hill.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah, because obviously in New York City, there was basements.
Yeah.
Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
I'm a beekeeper.
Really? Wow, that's interesting. So how did you get into that? And like, what do you, like, what's,
I got,
wait a minute, you're a beekeeper because, comma, and fill in the blank. What is the,
I love honey.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's literally, that might be the best answer I've had. So you just like, how many bees do you have?
Well, each hive can have about 60,000 bees. So there, I have one hive, and then I take care of a friend of mine's two extra hives. So even though I don't own the other hives, and so I don't keep the honey from those, I take care of all three. So theoretically, you could say that I have 180,000.
So when you get a town, does somebody have to watch your bees, or like, how does that work?
No,
like having a cat or?
No, they take care of themselves.
What do you have in your backyard?
No, I have them on a friend's property.
Wow.
But yeah, beekeeping, you gotta go and you gotta check on them, and the other flip side of this is I have this major allergy to bee stings. I've gone to the hospital because of it.
Nice.
Yeah. So if I get stung, I tend to blow up, but,
dude, there's gotta be some sort of like, what's that? masochistic, something funky up there. Let me pick something I'm deadly allergic to and get involved with it.
Yeah. Well, the goal was not to get stung.
yeah. But isn't that impossible? I mean, because as what I understand, I mean, you got 60, 180,000 bees circling around, and just statistically, you're going to get stung.
Yeah, you're going to get stung. Yeah.
Wow.
I thought, I'm not going to get stung. And then I started getting stung. So then I started learning what I was doing wrong, but I still get stung. But you know, it's funny because it's just a weird little thing that you know, I just wanted to have my own honey. I really, as stupid as that sounds, that's the answer. I really wanted my own honey. I love honey.
I
think pee like crazy. So I drink a ton of green tea, and nothing goes with green tea better than honey. So.
Totally get it. No, this is just, you know what? This is things, you don't have kids, right?
Not yet,
yeah,
no.
This is things people don't have kids do, because like, yeah. It's like, why not? Yeah. I mean, you know, like, hey, I enjoy honey. Let me get some pee. Why the hell not? Now, if you have kids, it's like, no, I just don't, you just like the bandwidth doesn't, you know, yeah. Like, you know, you take up a hobby like drinking or something like that. If you don't have the kids for 5 minutes, you know, but that sounds totally cool. It sounds something like interesting, and I would do the same thing if I was into honey and I didn't have any kids, you know, totally.
I mean, I'm not like crazy into honey. That's just a funny answer because that's all I can tell you. There's a lot of other things. Bees are pretty interesting animals, you know, but I really did it because to me it was a challenge. I wanted to do something that was completely out of my comfort zone, that I could have a lot of freedom. And I would have an interesting benefit from it. And for whatever reason, beekeeping just stuck out to me. Is this be interesting? This be something interesting to do?
It's like a science project.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. No, because it's like intellectually stimulating, and there's responsibility, and you get involved with nature. No, I could see it being a product.
And honeybees. I mean, not to get into a crazy thing about honeybees, but honeybees play such an unbelievably important role in our food chain. You know, whether that be if you're eating completely organic food, like you know stuff that's grown from the earth, that's awesome. But if you're also a meat eater, the cows and the chickens that provide the meat that you eat, they're fed food that's been pollinated by bees.
I didn't know that. I knew they were important. I didn't know how. Interesting.
Honeybees, you know, if honeybees die, we die.
Hmm.
Because they're the main pollinators of every food source that we have.
That's awesome, man. Very cool. I almost want to ask you a second thing that people would find, since that one was so interesting, is there a second thing people would find odd? Yeah, that was such a good answer.
I mean, that I'm interested in. I mean, I have hobbies outside of that.
Yeah, what are your hobbies, man?
I'm big into boating.
Really?
I love boating.
Like what? Saltwater, freshwater?
Well, in Nashville, we only have lakes around here.
Yeah.
So it would be freshwater. But
do you fish? Yeah.
No, I don't fish. But you know, I did a session with I was in a recording session a while back, and a number of years ago, meaning. And afterwards, my buddy and I met up with another friend, and out on the lake, he brought his boat out on the lake. I'd never been out on a boat on the lake.
Really?
And I thought, this is the coolest thing in the world. So I decided I had to buy a boat.
It's very relaxing.
So, I am. And it's awesome. So, you know, I go out on the boat, obviously not during this time of year, but when it warms up, I'm out every weekend. I'll go out sometimes during the week, you know, with what I get to do. If I'm not inspired that day or whatever, and it's a nice day, then I'll go out on the lake and spend the day out on the lake and have some friends come out and grill out.
Very cool.
So it's awesome.
That is cool. It's not, you weren't going out with Casey Wozner by any chance, was it?
No.
Do you know Casey?
No, I don't.
He's into boating too.
Okay, yeah, cool. Yeah. He sounds like a good guy.
Yeah, he is. A little younger guy, but he's a really cool guy. Very smart dude.
Awesome.
Happiest time in your life, I would imagine it's now.
You know, I'm pretty happy now. I think, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. So I always refer back to 2007 was best year of my life. That's the year that I'm always trying to recapture. But I think in hindsight, I'll look back on this year and be like, that was the best year. I'm more excited about 2018 than I've been about any year probably since I first moved to Los Angeles in 2003.
Why?
Why not? I guess it's there's so many – I'm healthy. I get to do things that I absolutely love to do. Right now I have great friends. You know, musically I'm stable and I'm happy. Financially I'm stable and I'm happy. And on top of that, I realized that you know, one of the things that I love more than anything else is helping younger artists and musicians figure out their game plan, you know, figure out what it's going to take for them to succeed in their career. And you know, one thing that I get asked about all the time over the last number of years is I have guys who are out on the road, you know, starting families, who are always calling me going like, man, I just want to get off the road and I just want to do what you do. And by do what I do, they mean sit in my studio and write music all day and play guitar. And there are a lot of benefits that come with this, with writing music for TV, you know, and building a catalog of intellectual property that creates mailbox money in the long run and all that other goodness. So one of the things that I love is just helping other people do that. And you know, this year I just decided that I was going to start actively teaching people who are interested the method that I've used to be able to be successful writing and licensing my songs to TV and film and movie trailers and commercials and video games and all that other stuff.
And let's just say where it's at now, and you can find it at mastermusiclicensing.com.
Yeah. So mastermusiclicensing.com is basically there's an ebook that I started, that it's free. Anyone can just go to mastermusiclicensing.com and download the ebook. It's 100% free. And that outlines my four steps that I use with every single song that I've placed in TV shows. It's, I'm not holding anything back. There's more to the story, and it starts with, you know, a book I read last year that changed my life and my perspective of things. And I realized that, you know, my focus has changed now that I'm in my 40s. You know, up until really I turned 40, it had been, you know, about, you know, being a successful guitar player, proving that I can, you know, be a successful musician and, you know, making good money and writing songs that people would hear. And in the last couple of years, I realized it changed to, you know, what became important to me was helping and inspiring others to pursue their passions and achieve their dreams. Cause I really achieved all my musical dreams. And it was so important for me to do that. And I understand how important it is for others. So it came about through that. And so I just, you know, the thing that's worked for me has been licensing my songs to TV. And it's allowed me a lot of creative freedom. I can write the music that I want to write, and I can write the music I'm passionate about. And it's allowed me a lot of financial freedom. I can have bees and I can have a boat, other junk that I want, and not worry about, you know, going to a job that I hate or how I'm going to pay the mortgage next month. So, so to me, I'm real passionate about that because I see it as such a viable way for musicians to be able to make a great, consistent, income, you know, and have a recurring source of revenue in their life. And so, yeah, so you go to mastermusiclicensing.com. You can download. There's a free ebook. I'm finishing up a course. I'm not sure if the course will be up by the time the podcast is, but if it is, you'll see it. If not, then there's just a free ebook, and you can stay on top of what's going on. There's also a blog where I share a lot of information on what I've learned. It's basically my way of mentoring younger people and younger musicians in a way that would allow them to have financial security, because that's the one thing, you know, musicians want two things. We want financial stability and we want creativity. We want the creative freedom to go off and do what we want to do. And what I've been successful at in the world of music licensing has allowed both. It's allowed financial freedom and it's allowed creative freedom. And I think that's the most important thing, at least for me, for musicians. That's the thing I've seen that every musician wants. And then on top of it, the beautiful aspect of it is that millions of people get to hear the songs that we write. We put it out there and millions of people around the world hear the music that we create and we get paid for it.
Awesome. I'm going to ask you one more question, man. I could literally talk to you like all afternoon. What's been the biggest change in your personality over the last, let's say, 5 or 10 years, 10 years? And has it been deliberate or just naturally occurring?
Honestly, I think the biggest change in my personality over the last 10 years, if I think to when I was 32, right? Go back 10 years, think when I was 32. I know exactly where I was when I was 32. I was focused on me. I had a band at the time. You know, we were getting a lot of TV placements, but we were also playing all the clubs in LA. We were trying to get the record deal, and it was all about us 100% of the time. My shift has probably been natural because now what I love to do is I love to take the time with young artists and musicians, and I love helping formulate a game plan for them. Let's figure out what your goals are, and let's work backwards, and let's figure out a game plan for you. And so I think it's been that shift. It's been that shift from being very selfish and self-motivated to having a goal of, you know, really wanting to help and inspire others, you know, accomplish their dreams, you know, not only pursue what they're passionate about, but actually accomplish it because I know it's possible. I know it's possible because I did it. And if I can do it, believe me, anyone can.
And to your defense, though, you probably, selfish is probably a bit of a harsh word because if you're pursuing your own goals, you know what I'm saying? There's nothing selfish about that. Yeah, I think if you pursue your own goals at others' expense, maybe, that's where that selfish moniker comes in. I think you're probably a little hard on yourself.
You're right. You definitely clarified it. You know, when you're hurting other people and you know, you're just bowling over other people. Yeah, that's selfish and terrible. But I think the attitude is for me, you know, when I think back to when I was 32, I was focused on my career. And fortunately, I'm at a point now where my career is pretty stable and it's pretty established, and I have my outlets and they're in place and everything is good. But I also fully understand the struggle of other musicians wanting to have that financial freedom and wanting to have the creative freedom and wanting to have something that you know, when you play a gig for someone, when you're paid at the end of the night, that you're done. You know, but being able to create some type of intellectual property, aka a song, that's actually going to get out there and that can make you money down the road many times over. There's so much power in that, and it's more than financial. The power is it allows you to mentally step away from worrying about always chasing every gig, and just focus on building your creative, you know, your sound catalog, your catalog of music, which is ultimately what's going to build create opportunities for placement. It's going to build your wealth. And so for me at this point in my life, I'm really interested in helping others figure out how to do that.
Right. Well, cool, man. Like I said, I could talk to you forever. I really appreciate your time and your candor. And again, let me just tell everybody, it's Mike Elsner. Go to mastermusiclicensing.com if you're interested in checking out Mike's licensing book. Go to Michael Elsner, ELSNER.com, and you could learn more about what he's doing, and all his social media channels are on there. Man, I really appreciate it. You're a super good guy. I know we'll be talking again for sure.
It's been awesome. I had a great time.
Same here, man. Thank you. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Gather your bees, make some honey, and thanks so much to Mike Elsner for spending all this time with us. I really appreciate it. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com and sign up to get notified of future episodes along with some cool stuff we're rolling out. And be nice, go play your guitar, and most important, have some fun. Until next time, peace and love, and I am out.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.